From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. And it would appear that every year he comes up with a new curmudgeonly rule. The rule this year, apparently, is that there is now in the Tom Sherwood rule book a rule that says you cannot wish people Happy New Year after a certain date. What date would that be, sir?
Well, me personally, it's 3 o'clock on New Year's Day. It just, you know, we're maybe it's because I'm too busy, but I feel like January is already a month old. We're well into a week of January, and when someone says those three words to me, I can almost not say them. It just seems kind of awkward.
So, as far as you're concerned, the year at this point is already old.
I've already had enough meetings at my office to ruin the entire year, so we'll just keep moving ahead. Let's look forward to February. You know, they already have Valentine's Day candy out, so let's move on. And for those people who keep their Christmas lights up into March and April, this year they should have a resolution. Take it down.
This year, if you were the law, they'd probably be arrested.
Right, there'd be all kinds of rules.
Joining us in studio, our guest is Ralph Northam. He is Virginia's Lieutenant Governor. Lieutenant Governor Northam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me here today, Kojo.
If you have questions or comments for the Lieutenant Governor, you can call us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Mr. Lieutenant Governor, I forgot to say Happy New Year.
Oh, I do.
And Happy New Year to you and your listeners as well.
Well, you know, the fact is, just to be, if we're going to be correct about everything, I should say, it's proper to call you governor, isn't it, right?
We don't really
throw the lieutenant in there.
I've been called a lot of different things, but lieutenant, governor, Ralph, I think
courtesy-wise is you don't say H New Year after 3 o'clock on the day, and then you say governor.
Let's start.
Because he's already announced for governor, so we might as well get used
That's
to it. If he wins, so it won't be odd to him.
Well, let's start with D.C. politics for a second, because there is a new political action committee that has been formed by the former campaign manager for former Mayor Vincent Gray, Chuck Thies. However, he says this PAC is only for the purpose of conducting an opinion poll, after which he will shut it down. The PAC does not seek to influence voters or advocate for any particular candidate. Campaign donations to $500 per person, limited. But what opinion is he looking for? Opinions?
Well, I think, you know, Chuck Thies, who was the campaign manager for Vince Gray's unsuccessful run for re-election, he started this PAC called Higher Ground. It was, I think the name was kind of picked to tweak Mayor Bowser's Fresh PAC. But he was pretty straightforward with it. He was irritated the Post story about it suggested it was some kind of another unwanted PAC in town. He created the PAC to have a poll to judge the political opportunities for someone to run for the council. Everyone believes that someone is Vince Gray, and I don't doubt that that's who it is. But it's pretty straightforward. He says he's releasing the poll. He's going to release the results. He's asking what the people think of the media, which ought to give him a nice answer to talk about for a couple of days. It's perfectly fine. There's nothing to it at all. He's just doing it because Vince Gray is trying to decide whether he's going to run at large, which would help him run for mayor again, you know, 4 years out, or whether he'll run for the Ward 7 seat against Yvette Alexander, and where he was very popular.
Speaking of deciding whether to run in Virginia, former Senator Jim Webb is deciding whether or not he's going to run for president as an independent. As you know, he started out running as a Democrat and then dropped out of the Democratic presidential primary back in October, saying he no longer felt comfortable as a Democrat. He is an individual who has admirers in both parties, and so now he's seriously considering, I guess, running as an independent.
Well, Governor here may have better talk about it, but are we streaming today?
We are streaming. We're live video streaming.
You can see me drop my head when
at
you said that story.
Kojoshow.org.
Yes. I dropped my head because I have the greatest respect for Jim Webb. I probably think he might even be a good president. But you have to campaign to win those offices. He couldn't make it in the Democratic primary campaign. I just don't see the path that he has. And people should respect him for what he has done, who he is. I just don't understand this flirtation or this desire to run a campaign for president.
He's reputed not to have a great deal of affection for glad-handing, a lot of the stuff that goes into campaigning. What do you think, Governor Northam?
Well, like Tom said, Kojo, I mean, he's a great man. He's done great work. I mean, he's served our country valiantly. The GI Bill, I'm a veteran of the U.S. Army, and what he's done with the GI Bill, making sure that our veterans can have access to education is wonderful, I believe. It is a tough row to hoe, though, as an independent in this current political environment, and so I admire him for what he's doing, but I think he'd be tough to do, and I think we have good candidates on the Democratic side. It's been interesting, entertaining to watch what's going on the Republican side. But anyway, I think it'll be tough for Senator Webb.
You know, he stepped away from the Senate. You know, he won, and carried the combat boots around the state, and he won, but then he didn't run for re-election. I don't know. Maybe we should have him in as a guest.
Good idea, Senator Webb. Anytime, feel free to call us. We'd be happy to have you on.
We'll make it the politics hour so I can be on.
On to Governor Northam. Healthcare for women has been an issue in Virginia, including strict regulations for abortion clinics that pro-choice advocates say are designed to close them down. Earlier today, before coming here, you announced a pilot program promoting access to reproductive health services in Virginia. What would that look like?
Yeah, I was up at Northern Virginia Community College just a little bit ago, Kojo, and I think we can all agree, whether you're Republican or Democrat, that the less unplanned, unintended pregnancies that we have in Virginia, the less abortions that we have in Virginia, the better. So what this plan is, it's a pilot program, and it's $9 million that we have introduced of federal money into Virginia's budget, and it will educate women across the Commonwealth and allow them access, if they so choose, to different forms of contraception. It will also offer education to providers who are counseling and providing the contraception to women. So, again, I think it's a good program. We looked at a program out of Colorado, actually, that did this over a five-year period. And by increasing access to contraception, again, if they so chose, to women, the incidence of unintended pregnancies went down 40%. The incidence of abortions went back down 42%. Those are powerful numbers, and we think we have a great opportunity to do it here in Virginia. And as you probably know, the governor formed the Children's Cabinet. Within the Children's Cabinet, we have the Commonwealth Council for Childhood Success, which I chair. We're looking at increasing access to pre-K education, making sure that we have quality and affordable child care across the Commonwealth, making sure that our children are healthy when they go to school, that their immunizations are up to date. And so we just provided, as part of this council, 16 recommendations to the governor, and this pilot program is one of those 16 recommendations.
Is this something political conservatives should be supporting?
Well, I think so, Tom. It should be nonpartisan. And, I mean, we encourage abstinence, but we also understand the reality that a number of our young women before they're married and even after they're married are sexually active, and so that they should have access to the best forms of medical care and the best forms of contraception that we have. So, I think it should be a nonpartisan issue.
I know that you specifically said it's $9 million in federal fund. Is there importance that it's federal funding and not state funding of support?
I think there is, Tom. And, we obviously are going to Richmond here in a few days to balance our budget. And this is money that's coming in from the federal government. It's not coming out of our general fund. So I think there'll be less of an argument for our legislators to say that, this is something that they can't support because it's coming out of the general fund. This isn't coming out of the general fund. It won't affect our budget.
It is possible that someone in the legislature could try to move to block this funding.
It's always possible, Tom.
800-433-8850. In case you're just joining us, our guest is Ralph Northam. He is the Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. You can call him or ask him questions by calling that number, or you can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream of the conversation, send us a tweet at kojoshow or email to kojo@wamu.org. Staying with health-related issues, as a state senator from 2008 through to 2013, you focused on a number of health-related initiatives, including banning smoking in restaurants, focusing on young athletes and concussions. This week, Senator Cree Deeds filed a wrongful death lawsuit over the mental health care his son received in 2013 before stabbing Senator Deeds and then taking his own life. He introduced legislation that would address the area of the system that failed his son, but obviously he believes that there was negligence involved. But the state mental health care in Virginia has been an area of concern in general, even before the tragedy in Senator Deeds' family. There was the Virginia Tech shooter. What issues do you think still need to be addressed?
A great question, Kojo. And Senator Deeds and I are very dear friends and just been a tremendous public servant to the Commonwealth of Virginia. And what a tragedy that he and his family have gone through. And as you just mentioned, you know, the tragedy that we had at Virginia Tech in 2007, 32 lives were lost in. And we took some measures back then when Governor Kane was governor, made some improvements. And then when Cree's son tragically killed himself, it was on the radar screen again. So then Governor McDonald formed the Mental Health Task Force. And then Governor McAuliffe took over, obviously, in 2014 and continued that. And I have chaired the Mental Health Task Force. And we have looked at several areas to include crisis intervention and have made some, I think, good improvements. The second area is ongoing therapy. We're obviously short on psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers across the Commonwealth, so we've increased funding for that. Law enforcement is a very important area and challenge for Virginia. Far too many of our mentally ill individuals across Virginia are in our jails and penitentiaries. And then finally, one of the other areas that we looked at is the use of technology and what we call telemedicine or telepsychiatry, reaching out to those underserved areas in Virginia. So good work is going on, Kojo. We still have a lot of work to do. You know, Cree, again, is a good friend. He's been very influential, not only on a state level, but a national level for this issue. And so I wish him the best and for him and his family.
There was some at the time that one of the issues was whether there were enough emergency facilities, beds, as they're called, for people who are having severe psychiatric reactions. Are there enough beds now? I mean, apparently, and going forward, it turns out there might have been some beds available, and that's part of this lawsuit. But yeah, is the state prepared now?
We do have beds, Tom, and the challenge, and we've alleviated a lot of the problem, was there was not a bed registry. In other words, the issue with Cree is that his son needed to be hospitalized, but as they tried to find a bed, there were none available. Now, the reason for that is there were none available of where they were trying, but now we have this bed registry, so anybody that needs inpatient treatment will be given a bed somewhere across the Commonwealth of Virginia. So we have taken care of that.
Okay, good.
Yesterday, a federal court picked a new congressional map for Virginia, which had illegally created districts to concentrate black voters into two districts. Allow me to go to the phones. Put on your headphones, gentlemen, because that is an issue that V in Bristol, Virginia, would like to address. V, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Thank you. First of all, Lieutenant Governor Northam, thank you for the work you are doing for the Commonwealth. You represent us with grace and dignity. My question is, with all the Democrats in statewide positions but a Republican majority in the congressional delegation, it seems like we need some changes in Virginia. Do you have a comment on how our Virginia redistricting cases are going?
Yes, thank you for the question, and I hope everything in your part of Virginia is going well. But as you know, this was a lawsuit that was brought forward. The the decision was made to redraw not only the 4th, but also the 3rd Congressional District. The 2nd Congressional District is also involved. And so the maps have been redrawn. The case is still going to be looked at by the U.S. Supreme Court. But what these would do would certainly make our districts, especially those in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, which are in the eastern part of Virginia extending in toward Richmond, would make them more balanced and give other individuals opportunities to run in districts that have, again, to this point, have not been fairly drawn.
But this court may not be the final word. The Supreme Court could toss the whole thing out.
Well, and if they do, then we'll have to go back to ground one or ground zero. But we'll see what they decide to do, and then we'll move forward from there. But it's the right thing to do, Kojo.
We're in the political season for the 16 elections. Is this something the Supreme Court will, in fact, make a fairly quick decision on? It won't wait until the midsummer, right? This is something they'll take up fairly quickly.
You know, Tom, I would think they would, because obviously the elections are right around the corner from us in the fall of 2016. So the plan is to have this settled by then, so that individuals that want to run and those that are incumbents can plan for their campaigns.
Democrat Bobby Scott, and I think it's the 3rd district from your area of the state, he embraces the change. He says it's not right that African Americans are all shunted into his one district, and that this changes something like Henrico County, even and on the suburbs of Richmond, could make a big difference. And for the Democrats, at least, to have a more level playing field.
It sure
will.
What is
the legal argument against this? And what the Republicans are saying, what?
Well, I don't know what the Republicans.
Whether you agree with the argument or not, I can't articulate it probably as clearly as you could.
Well, I don't know really what a good argument for. You know, the districts have been gerrymandered, Tom, and so the number of African Americans that have been packed into Congressman Scott's district as compared to those around are totally out of balance. And so about 10% shift has occurred, at least with the new map, in the 3rd Congressional District, and about 10% in the 4th as well. So it'll be much fairer, I believe, and better for democracy in Virginia.
Now, while we're at the Supreme Court, we can't let it go. Bob McDonnell's case is before the Supreme Court today. I think there's some hearings on it, and then they'll decide sometime before June whether he will have either a new trial or something will happen, or he'll be going to prison. Any thoughts about that now?
No,
because you've known him too for a while.
He has been a good public servant. I'm sorry that he and his family are going through what they've been going through. A lot of improvements have been made in ethics reform in Virginia. And again, you know, that's going to be up to the Supreme Court. But I, again, being a public servant as he is, I wish him and his family the best.
Do you think, Matt, just one quick thing?
Sure.
If the Supreme Court says the case was improperly handled, do you think he should be tried again, or should that be the end of it?
I would hope that just for his family and for the Commonwealth that would be the end of it.
The Ethics Commission created by Governor McAuliffe issues its recommendations at the end of last month. Among those recommendations are creating an independent panel to adjudicate ethics violations by public officials and a separate redistricting commission. What's the likelihood that those things will actually happen?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, Kojo, and I've been a patron of a nonpartisan redistricting bill for a number of years before I was elected to the lieutenant governor's position. And each year it passed in the Senate with flying colors, and then it would get to the other end of the Capitol in the House and in an early morning subcommittee be defeated. But you know, the majority, the great majority of Virginians believe that we should take as best we can the politics out of redistricting, to have a nonpartisan redistricting commission. And so I'm very much in support of doing that. Whether that will be politically viable is another question.
Well, you know, speaking of politics, the Virginia Republican Party says you have to have a statement of affirmation that you are, in fact, a Republican if you're going to vote in, I think, the March primary. Do you think that's something that a party should do? I'm not even sure. Why does the state even pay for these private party primaries?
Well, Tom,
you don't pay for Republican conventions, do you?
No, I'm just proud to be a Democrat. And, we have primaries where anybody that wants to go vote at the polls on that day can vote. And that's the way it should be, in my opinion.
for the state to, I mean, all the states do it, so I'm not even sure I'm bringing it up, but it seems to me that this is the party function to pick your nominee, and then we pay as taxpayers for the general elections. But we just assume
the authors of this feel that they don't want the election results skewed by Democrats showing up at the polls to vote for people that the authors don't feel are real Republicans.
It's not in the law, though, that you have to be a Republican.
This is also true.
So we just follow the law, and that's the way we'll be.
Here now is Charlie in Arlington, Virginia. Charlie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask the Lieutenant Governor, I really want to see Governor McCullough's Medicaid expansion happen, and I just want to know if you see any hope in that, if gridlock's going to continue, or if we might get something through this time.
Charlie, thank you for the question, and I hope you and all other Virginians understand what's at stake here with Medicaid expansion. We have paid into the federal system to support the Affordable Care Act, and really all we're trying to do is bring that money back to Virginia. We have already, since January of 2014, given over $3 billion, with a B, dollars to surrounding states that we compete with. So from a business perspective, it makes absolutely no sense not to expand Medicaid. And from a moral perspective, we have 400,000 working Virginians right now who don't have coverage. And when individuals don't have coverage, they end up going to the emergency room. There's a time and a place for the emergency room, but it's not where preventive care takes place, primary care, not where good education takes place. So from a moral perspective, we need to move forward with Medicaid expansion. That is a large part of our budget, as you know, that Governor McAuliffe has submitted. So we're going to do everything we can to move that forward. And the last thing I may say, Kojo, if it's okay, as a veteran of the Army, there are thousands of these 400,000 working Virginians who are our veterans. They are ones that have protected us, have risked their lives for our freedoms. The least that we can do is Virginians, as make sure that they and their families are covered with health care when they return to this country.
The Republicans complain that it's not quite a trick, but that what happens is the federal government entices you into this program by paying most of the cost, and then down the road, the state is liable for the cost. What is the response to that?
Well, there are a lot of situations, Tom. It's a great question that we rely on federal funding. And so to say that we're worried that the feds are going to renege and not support Medicaid expansion, I think is a very weak excuse. And again, this is money that we've sent to Washington, and all we're asking is to bring it back to Virginia.
Here now is Tierna in Washington. Tierna, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I'm calling to ask about comments about family planning earlier in the program. The Lieutenant Governor spoke about educating women about contraception, and I was wondering if there's been any discussion about educating men about contraception or the implications of pregnancy for women.
Paula, you should know Tierna, you should know we got a tweet from Paula who says, hey, it takes two to tango. Can we educate young, sexually active men about contraception as well?
Well, I think that's a great point that she makes. And to date, as you know, there are no means of contraception for men other than abstinence and the use of condoms. And so most of it has gone in the direction of women. And so as we sit here today on January the 8th, this is what we're focused on with this particular pilot program. And we just want to make sure that women across the Commonwealth of Virginia are educated, that they have access to the best forms of contraception, and that also that providers are also educated as to what the best, most effective, safest method of contraception are, and that they can provide that for women across the Commonwealth.
Tierna, thank you very much for your call. When we last spoke, it looked like you and Attorney General Mark Herring could be facing off in a primary in a run for governor, but it looks like the AG has decided to run for that office again. What are your specific plans at this point?
Well, I'm running for governor, Kodjo. The attorney general has done great work, marriage equality across the Commonwealth of Virginia. He's been responsible for that. He's certainly done a lot of good work for the Dreamers, making sure that children that have been raised in Virginia have access to higher education in Virginia, protection of the Chesapeake Bay. So he is very proud of what he's done. There are things that he wants to continue to work on. And Mark and I met, I guess, 2 or 3 months ago, and he said that he was planning on running for re-election as Attorney General. He asked for my support, which I have given him. He's supporting me. We're going to have a combined campaign. You know, we're very proud, Kodjo, of the economic development that has taken place across the Commonwealth. We have brought in over 84,000 new jobs to the Commonwealth in the last 2 years, over $9 billion of capital investment. I want to continue to work on the issues that we've been working on there, and also health care. My background is in health care, and I want to make sure that all Virginians have access to affordable and quality health care. So that's why I want to be the next governor.
This is the politics hour. Who initiated that meeting between you and Mark Herring? Did he call you or did you call him?
He called me, and he wanted to know if I was going to be in Richmond. I was on call at the hospital that week, and he said he would be glad to drive down. We met in my office for about a half an hour, and that was the decision that was made.
Is there any suggestion that he, all the things you just cited him for doing as Attorney General, that might make it more difficult for him to run for governor, and it makes better sense for him to run for Attorney General again?
You know, I think Mark has provided a great service for Virginia. We talked about a lot of different things when we ran in 2013. He's been a man of his word. He's gotten a lot of great things done. And he and I think, working together as a team with Governor McAuliffe, have been very successful in again, the new Virginia economy, providing jobs for Virginians, and, again, moving Virginia in a positive direction.
Well, one last question. You're going to work as a team with Mark Herring. Well, what about who's going to run for lieutenant governor? Have you guys decided who that person should be?
Well, you know, I know it's his birthday today, but I was actually going to talk to Kodjo about that as soon as we get off the
air. He doesn't live in the Commonwealth.
Well, you wouldn't want him anyway.
I might
be persuaded to do that.
He couldn't withstand a background check.
Well, you never know. We're running out of time very quickly, but you never know where you might be able to find votes. Are you aware, Mr. Governor, that the No Pants Subway Metro ride is back this Sunday, January 10th?
I bet he doesn't even know about this event in the district.
The No Pants Metro ride. Tom Sherwood, will you be participating?
I prefer to stay fully clothed in public, but it is a cool thing. You probably haven't even heard of it, have you?
Well, I haven't, Tom, but I'm going to focus on the Redskins this weekend, so I wasn't going to talk about No Pants.
Well, you know, it's men and women. They just go from like 1 to 4 in the afternoon, so you can see it before the Skins game. They just go on the subway, ride the rails in all the jurisdictions wearing underwear.
Sounds like it'd be a good time for me to stay in Virginia.
This is not a district thing. This is a D.C., Maryland, and Virginia thing.
Hey, there might be Virginia voters there. You can never tell.
Right. Ralph Northam. Governor, for your campaign, Governor.
Ralph Northam is Virginia's Lieutenant Governor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me today.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Joining us shortly will be Kenyon McDuffie. He is a D.C. council member representing Ward 5 in the District of Columbia. And Tom Sherwood, former D.C. Congressman Walter Fauntroy, who's now 82 years, seems to have moved on. Johnny Barnes, his associate who once worked for the congressman, said he had received an email from the U.S. Department of State saying that Fauntroy has apparently left the United Arab Emirates and that he doesn't know exactly where he is right now, but he's no longer there. He was supposed to be in Dubai for a while. His disappearance has been mysterious. He's got a lot of friends and family and others concerned about his well-being and his whereabouts.
Yeah, and I'm part of that concern. I've done a couple of stories over the last year or so about this. I mean, his wife is here and up off of 16th Street on 7th, and she's been in touch with him occasionally with phone calls. He's been in touch with some emails and some phone calls. He hasn't quite explained why he won't come back to home. He hasn't quite explained what he's doing. There was an effort by the family, with the State Department, with its worldwide resources, was asked, can you inquire about this? And they came back with a fairly, I thought, weak answer that, well, we don't know. And so this is very discouraging to Joe Madison, the radio host, and among others, have raised money to help the family, have done all sorts of things. This is a terrible situation for someone who was, you know, the right-hand man, as we often say, of Martin Luther King, who served for 20 years as the congressional representative for the district, who for many reasons, I was a pastor here in town,
New
Bethel Baptist Church. I mean, there's so many things for him to just kind of slip off the radar. I just find it unacceptable, and I wish that the administration would do something more, the Obama administration would do something more to find out what's going on.
As we said, joining us in studio now is Kenyon McDuffie. He is a D.C. council member representing Ward 5. Councilmember McDuffie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kojo.
If you have questions or comments for the council member, call us at 800-433-8850. You can watch our live video stream and ask questions or make comments at kojoshow.org. Send an email to kojo@wamu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Are you going to announce today that you're participating in the No Pants Subway Metro ride? By any chance?
I had not planned to.
Well,
you
can change your plans at any point.
If this happens, I would work on Sunday. I'm off Sunday, but I would have a camera. I just want you to know this would be.
Oh, boy.
On to the business at hand. We had Mayor Bowser on the show on Monday. She talked about her Stronger, Safer D.C. plan. After a year that saw a 54% increase in homicides, she criticized the council for failing to act on the legislation which she first proposed in August. As chair of the Judiciary Committee, you are central to that process, but you say you want to see more data.
Can we make this even harder?
Yes.
Her whole administration, if you talk to anybody in her administration, saying it's your fault.
They blame him.
She talked about this legislation in August. She introduced it in September. You didn't move fast enough on it, and now we're in a situation where you had to do some emergency legislation on security cameras this past week, and that we had this embarrassment over marijuana because you didn't move any marijuana updates in your Judiciary Committee, that you have simply not done your job, and all these problems are your fault.
Well, obviously, I would disagree with the characterization that's been said that anything is my fault. And I also am not going to engage in finger pointing because it's simply not counterproductive. In fact, it's counterproductive. When I've talked to residents, as I have as chair of the Committee on Judiciary, both in Ward 5 and across the city, they said that crime is a top priority. But they also have said that it's important that we approach it in a way that's measured and that's smart. And so we need to be safer, but we also need to be smarter. As about how we do our crime policies in the District of Columbia, not to be knee-jerk and reactionary, to be thoughtful and to look at what is actually going to have a positive impact on communities and help improve their quality of life. And that's simply what we've been able to do and focus on. And you know, perhaps there's some who would have liked to have seen things happen quicker, but it's important for people to note that I chair a committee that has about 35 agencies, boards, and commissions with a $1.4 billion budget and 9,800 FTEs. And so we've got a lot of issues.
Those are full-time employees for those of us who don't.
So we cover issues from public safety, but we also have issues related to ethics, elections, and campaign finance. And so we've had 35 hearings in 2015. We've had a number of bills that have come out of our committee. We've covered issues like homicides, violent crime, the response to the LaFont Plaza Metro incident, youth violence, the President's 21st Century Policing Task Force, the state of emergency medical services and response times and things that are really important to people.
You told me this week when we were talking about this and you said it to other reporters, I think it was in the Post and other outlets, that one of your complaints was that the chief had not met with you. I think there was one meeting that was scheduled in September that was canceled or whatever, but that more importantly, you had asked for four or five data collections so you can make decisions on what the legislation should say or not, and that you're not getting the information without finger-pointing, as I just did. But are you saying there's a substantive reason why you haven't moved faster on the legislation that the mayor introduced, and it's not because you don't care as much about it?
So what we've done when we've had hearings on these bills, and we have had hearings on
these
bills.
Is that right, though? You haven't gotten the information.
That is accurate.
Okay.
That's very accurate, Tom. As a matter of fact, following the hearing that we had on both the bill that I introduced as well as the bill that was sent down by the mayor, we made specific data requests and other information, and we made those during the hearing and both following up after the hearing. And some of those requests have yet to be fulfilled. Again, not to point fingers, but to suggest that we need to be supported by data to know whether or not these are things that we should be implementing here in the District of Columbia.
Any indication that you will be getting this data?
I have not gotten any indication that I will be getting the data. As a matter of fact, there's some who suggested that we should just move on without getting it. And I think that runs counter to sound, smart criminal justice reform here in the District of Columbia.
You did tell the chairman that you would try. I mean, I think he was saying at the breakfast you guys had that I attended this week that you might have a committee vote on or for the council some legislation on crime as early as early February, February 4th.
That's an important point to make, Tom. So we have never stopped working on these bills. I don't want your listeners to think that we ever stopped working. It's just that there's certain aspects of the crime bill sent down by the mayor that were not supported by data, and so we moved on with other things. For example, we are keeping parts of her bill that would allow retired MPD officers to work for the Department of Forensic Sciences and retain their pensions. We're keeping the aspects of her bill that would allow increasing the availability of good time credits for folks who are in our jail, and also better and more robust work release programs. We are keeping parts of our bill that would allow MPD officers retention and recruitment incentives. And so there are certain things that she sent down that we really like. I like the fact that she's put grants out in communities that have some of the highest rates of violence in the District of Columbia. And I think that when you speak to residents who live in those communities, those are the types of things that they'd like to see more of. And so we want to work with the administration. And I think it's also important for your listeners to know that ultimately, I think Mayor Bowser and I share the same goal, and that is to reduce violent crime, particularly gun violence here in the District of Columbia. We may have different approaches to this, but we have the same goal in mind. And we're going to work together to make sure we implement something that is going to help residents of the District of Columbia.
She had a big press conference at the Eastern Market Metro stop on Capitol Hill Tuesday. The Attorney General Carl Racine was there. Two people from the U.S. Attorney's Office was there. The police chief was there. The Metropolitan the Subway police chief was there, Pavlik.
Is that the same press conference where some people broke into one of the TV
Yes, the Channel
vehicles?
7 people left their equipment out. The number one thing, please tell you, is don't leave all your equipment visible from whatever. So I could go on. There was a long list of people. Anita Bonds, a large council member, was there. Charles Allen, the Ward 6 council member, was there. Were you invited?
I don't know if I was invited, but
your staff would tell you if the mayor invites you.
I tell you what, I don't think that I have to be present at every press conference or every event where an announcement is made in order to be successful in implementing smart policies and legislation here in the District.
You were at the press conference when the mayor signed the bill on police cameras.
I was.
And I
was.
Called on you so you could be allowed to speak.
But well, let's talk about
no,
that.
But
that
point being, though, this fight with the mayor. This friction with the mayor, call it a friction, not a fight, is ongoing. It's very aggressive on their side. If you hear from them, they say, well, you haven't done this or you haven't done that. It is political, so maybe you will have to point some fingers back.
Well, you know, I'll leave it to residents to decide, how they think or respond to some of the allegations that have been made in the press. I am not going to continue to respond to those things in the press because we've got too much serious work to do. And again, that work involves making sure that we are implementing sound, smart, evidence-based, data-driven policies here in the District of Columbia. And that is our top priority.
Put on your headphones, please, because we have a caller who wants to address one of the issues that Tom peripherally raised earlier, and that here is Oscar in Ward 5. Oscar, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, well, two questions. Good afternoon, gentlemen. One, I need to know right away. You made a statement, Councilman McDuffie, that you and the mayor are on support the same goals for crime, and she won't give you the data. Wasn't invited to the conference. I don't know why you're trying to play it both ways. You need to call it like you see it. The mayor's not being responsive and not supportive of what you want to do. And you have to sometimes get away from trying to be the nice guy and play it both ways and just say it, that she is not being supported. And then the second thing I'd like to know quickly, are you planning to support her request not to expand marijuana use to some of these private clubs?
So we've already passed legislation via emergency that would restrict marijuana use to inside the home. And so I think that was the goal of the emergency that we passed last year. And we essentially put that same emergency in place again early this week. And I plan to move forward with permanent legislation in the committee. And we've already begun the conversations with my colleagues on the council to see if we can reach an agreement sooner rather than later, so we can have something ready for the February.
Do you personally have an opinion that the ban on private clubs having marijuana events, where they wouldn't sell it, but they would allow it to be smoked in outdoor places at private events, do you personally support that and haven't decided whether you want to move the legislation because you want to hear from a variety of views, or do you oppose that and still want to hear a variety of views? Where are you at this point? Well, if you had to vote today, how would you vote?
I think we have heard a variety of views. We had a hearing on this topic where the views expressed at the hearing were more sort of in line with each other, and there wasn't a variety necessarily at the hearing. But whenever I go out in public, particularly, you know, to places like Costco and other, you know, grocery stores, people are talking about these issues. And what they say is that the bottom line is it's important to proceed cautiously on this issue because there's still much to be learned about the health effects of marijuana use indoors, and we shouldn't rush this issue.
Is that your personal view at this point, that you don't want to expand the or allow the private use of marijuana in public settings, private club type settings?
I think that what's clear is that the District of Columbia residents do not want to use their criminal justice system to arrest and prosecute people for the use and possession of small amounts of marijuana.
I still don't know where you are.
Well, that's what I agree to. Okay. I agree wholeheartedly with that. I think the system, criminal justice system, should not be used to over-police in communities of color to arrest and prosecute people for possession and use of small amounts of marijuana. I wholeheartedly agree with it. I've been a former prosecutor. I've arrested.
Okay. What about this gentleman? I would have asked that same question if I had done it as well as he did. You can't always just be the nice guy in these tough political fights.
Well, it's not about being a nice guy. It's about doing what the residents of Ward 5 elected me to do.
I'm trying to provoke you.
I know, but I'm not going to take the bait, Tom. I mean, I'm going to work hard because that's what I was elected to do, is to deliver results, to be thoughtful about what we do, to do it in a way that's inclusive, to make sure that it represents the diverse population that we have in the District of Columbia.
And you're obviously working hard to do that, but you're obviously also not getting the kind of cooperation from the mayor that you would like to get. Why do you think that is happening?
I don't know. I mean, I can't answer that.
Have you asked the mayor?
I'll tell you what. I've had conversations with the mayor that have really gone well, where we have agreed on things like the final outcome for body-worn cameras. Although it took us 9 months to get to that place where I initially started out, at the end of the day, we came up with one of the most progressive and thorough and comprehensive body-worn camera programs in the country. I think it's going to be looked at as a model for other jurisdictions who want to implement them. And so I think there are positive things that we've been able to do. And I think it's more productive to focus on some of those accomplishments that we've had, because I think ultimately residents of the District of Columbia are tired of politicians pointing fingers at one another and not getting things done.
We got a tweet from someone here who wants to say, what data do you need from the mayor or the chief that you haven't, just name something that you haven't gotten from the chief that you want.
Sure. For example, part of the mayor's bill would have sentencing enhancements for crimes committed on public transportation or DPR facilities. And
That's the recreation department?
Yeah, yes. I think it's important before we move forth with, sort of stiffer penalties for people that we know that is supported by evidence. What jurisdictions have implemented policies like that, and how do they work? Does that show that it will prevent crime in these types of places? Because there's crimes happening on public transportation, but also crimes happening in communities throughout the District of Columbia every single day. In fact, there are certain communities where it's almost become routine that you see gun violence and you hear gunshots. And so I want to make sure that we are addressing the serious concerns where some of this violence and crime is occurring routinely, and that we're addressing more comprehensively how you reduce crime and violence and how you go to the root causes of it. And so when you talk about things that are happening in areas like Langston Carver Terrace or things that are happening in areas like Benning Terrace, it's not just simply about arresting our way out of these problems. It is about looking at the health crisis that we have in communities like that. It's about looking at the educational gaps that exist.
When people see crimes being committed on public transportation, buses or metro trains or in city parks, and a politician advocates stiffer sentences for those crimes because those crimes are the ones that are most highly publicized, invariably the public tends to go along with that, well, knee-jerk reaction to it. And by insisting on trying to find data before you come to a conclusion, you could be giving the impression that you are not, you don't see these as really emergency kinds of situations. You don't see any urgency at all.
It's quite the opposite, Kojo. I see these as some of the biggest priorities for the District of Columbia right now, and so much so that I am out in those communities. In addition to being an elected official, it's important for your listeners to understand, I grew up here in the District of Columbia. I care about this city more than any place in the world. And I have experienced the violence and the gun crimes that we've seen here in the District of Columbia firsthand. And so that's why I got into this line of work. I know it sounds trite, but I want to be able to solve these problems, but I don't want to do it in a way that is going to contribute to mass incarceration, which has proven to be discredited over the years when you resort to these tough-on-crime policies that were put in place by elected officials and politicians in the 80s and 90s just to show that they were tough, and it didn't result in the types of progress that we wanted to see. We still have these huge disparities in these communities of color where people are coming back home. Think about this, and it's important for people to understand this. We can stiffen sentences, and we can just go out and flood your communities with police officers, and they will make more arrests when you're policing.
People love it when politicians say they'll be tough on crime.
However, what you have to understand is in the District of Columbia, about approximately 70% of those folks who are prosecuted, are convicted, are sentenced, are coming right back home when they get released to these communities with the same problems that they left with. If we don't address the culture of violence, if we don't address these root causes that exist in these communities, we're going to continue to suffer the dire consequences that these people are suffering every single day. And I don't want to see that happen. So I'm not going to resort to these knee-jerk policies.
I understand the long-term problem with the long-term look, but the mayor doesn't want to be blamed for a big uptick in crime, a big increase in homicides, and she doesn't want to be blamed. And the people, I talked to one shop owner on Capitol Hill who said, well, it's a great place to live, and people feel generally safe, but now, just because there have been these number of incidences, they feel unsafe. And if people start to feel unsafe, they're not going to worry about the tail end of the judicial system.
I agree.
And so the mayor's trying to show action now just to kind of reassure people as well as actually do something. I don't think she wants to lock up hundreds or thousands of people for crimes, but I think she wants to, the police are down 300. That's on her watch. She's the mayor. It's the issue of people feeling unsafe that the elected leaders have to address.
And that's precisely right.
Your thoughtful handling of legislation doesn't
nobody
do that.
Nobody should be blaming the police department, nor should they be simply blaming the mayor for all the crime that's occurring here in the District of Columbia. I will say this, there's a way to act quickly and to act swiftly, but to do it in a way that's smart and not just simply reactive. And so I support making sure that the MPD has the tools that they need to police in communities across the District of Columbia. But I also want to make sure that we do it in a way that's thoughtful, that are engaging the community. Community policing should be the top priority. And not to forget that in addition to policing, we need to have the community's involvement. And I think there are ways to do that better. And we just simply need to make sure we're exploring that. We have to have better recruitment in MPD. We have to have better training.
Tom's question actually raises an amazing philosophical distinction between being the mayor, who's the executive who has to make things happen, and being a member of the council who has to legislate. And the mayor obviously wants action. The members of the council want to contemplate the issue a little more. But let's talk about...
Can we just mention Chuck Thies one more time?
No, why?
Because he's tweeted that the council member McDuffie is doing a good job handling the grilling here by you and me, and it's good training for the future mayoral bid.
Uh-oh.
I thought he was busy trying to get Mayor Gray reelected to something. Now he's promoting you for mayor.
Well,
this is the politics hour.
At the end of December, Mayor Bowser signed one of the most expansive body-worn camera programs in the country. You were the sponsor of that bill. You and other council members had issues with an amendment to that bill, the amendment that says that officers can review footage before they write their final reports. Talk about that.
Yeah, Coach Joe, we worked really hard over the course of 9 months to get to a policy that I think, as I mentioned earlier, is really thoughtful and is the most comprehensive body-worn camera regulatory regime in the country. And residents should be proud of that. And police officers should be proud of that. We're going to have ultimately 2,800 body-worn cameras on our officers when all the this is said and done. So that's positive. But I was disappointed in the amendment that was passed that would allow officers to view their body-worn camera's footage before writing their initial report. Now, here's why I think this is a very important issue. Officers work really hard when they're out there in the field, and they're making these decisions that are tough and frequently happen in a, you know, within a matter of seconds. And so it's important that when they come back to write a report about these, you know, particularly the violent crime
You're wearing
missions,
your prosecutor's hat now.
When they use their service weapons and police-involved shootings, that they don't incorporate simply what is recorded in the footage to make that report. We want to know what they were thinking, how they were feeling, and how they were reacting based on their own memory and recollection. We want a contemporaneous account of what happened, not an account that fills in the gaps once you look at the camera and say, you know what? Somebody's going to look at this camera and this footage and say, oh, I should have done this or I should have done that. So let me account for that in this initial report. That's not what we want. And I think either consciously or subconsciously, you're going to see officers looking at the footage before they write their reports and filling in the gaps and trying to have the perfect report.
And I was serious when I said you're wearing your prosecutorial hat now.
Well,
that observation seems to be based on your experience.
It's based on my experience as a prosecutor, but it's also based on my experience as a Department of Justice civil rights attorney, where I went out and I investigated police departments across the country. And I work with law enforcement, police practices experts about policies and procedures, about the use of force, about things that are quite frankly part of the problem that we're seeing in jurisdictions around the country. And body cameras, while a very important tool, they are not by themselves going to be able to account for what has historically been a really contentious, almost adversarial relationship between law enforcement and communities of color across the country.
Can on this subject, we in the media are concerned about the Freedom of Information Act. Oh, how quickly will we see this video? You've said before that if this video is not made public, and that's why you went against what the mayor wanted to keep it most of it secret, and said we are going to make this available in various circumstances, but we're concerned that the police department will foot drag, or even if the police are going to control it, who's going to control the release of this video so that the public can see it?
The Freedom of Information Act requests have to come through MPD, but it's also important to know that if a person is captured on the camera, they have access to that without going through the FOIA process.
We only have a minute left, and Jeff only wants to weigh in on this issue. Jeff, you're on the air. You only have about 30 seconds left. Go ahead, please.
Sure thing. Thank you, Chairman McDuffie, for being on the show. 7 months ago, Black Lives Matter leader DeRay McKesson and government accountability organization Muckrock submitted a FOIA request to the D.C. Police Department for their contract with the D.C. Police Union. It was part of the Police Union Contract Project, learning how police union contracts make it more difficult to hold police officers.
And what's been the response? What's been the response? We're out of time.
Well, it's been 7 months, and there has been no response.
We will follow up with that. I am familiar with, I think there was a tweet that came into my account about that, and we'll make sure my staff gets you some information, at least an update, as soon as possible.
Kenyon McDuffie is a D.C. council member who tweeted earlier today that he's enjoying, looking forward to coming on the show. Think he enjoyed it?
I think he did. He doesn't have to wear shoulder pads here.
Always a pleasure, John.
I was going for him hating it. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Nnamdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.